This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
They're trying to answer questions about upward mobility in America.
He's the military strategist. It was profiled brilliantly by somebody.
And so I think if you could, find the subculture of people
with a kind of form of life on this planet that we haven't really seen before.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. A co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
These kind of very pretty English villages always remind me of those kind of afternoon murder shows. Maybe you'll see a murder when you're out doing the lasering one night.
If that was the case, it would probably be my own.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today we're going inside the super secret location where a mad scientist is plotting a campaign of planetary conquest.
Nice pub, Hare and Hounds.
Although the scientist isn't really mad. Also, he's not exactly a scientist. He practices general medicine. And the location? Not a secret at all. It's behind the local pub. Dr. Phil Davies, would-be ruler of Mars, coming up later.
Left. So this is straight for a couple of miles.
But let's start a little closer to home. Since the day it passed, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, has been the clearest and biggest target of Republicans in Washington. The way Donald Trump was talking, Obamacare was going to be history the Monday after inauguration. But as we've seen, a repeal or replacement of Obamacare is much, much harder to do than to talk about. An oncologist and health policy expert named Ezekiel Emanuel, everybody calls him Zeke, was one of the architects of the ACA. He helped the Obama administration figure out just how to expand healthcare without exactly blowing up the national budget. And with the ACA on the chopping block, Emanuel is trying to influence what the Republicans can come up with to replace it. In this climate, it's almost impossible to have a cool-headed conversation about health care. But Emanuel insists we've got to try, and he's had closed-door meetings with the Trump administration. I spoke with Zeke Emanuel early last week as the Senate was poised to release a revised health care bill. Now, if I'm not mistaken, you met with President Trump about—
Three times.
So what were those conversations like?
Those conversations were quite good. The last time I met with him was the end of March, just before the Paul Ryan pulled the bill because he didn't have the votes. And I basically told him it was a terrible bill and would leave many people uninsured. It didn't address cost control. It was undermining of the market.
Does he have a grasp of the details?
He asked appropriate questions. In the room was not just him. It was Price and Ryan and Pence and Mulvaney.
So congressional leaders.
Yes. And we had a very thorough discussion, I would say, of the bill.
You're being diplomatic.
Yes. I mean, it's for the president to reveal the details if he wants to. I would just say—
But why be diplomatic?
I'm not for this bill. So yeah. I'll tell you why I think I want to be diplomatic. I'm not for this bill. I've made it clear to everyone, and I've said it on many media outlets, this bill is cruel, throwing 22 million people off insurance, creating uncertainty so that premiums go up.
This is the original Senate bill you're referring to.
Correct. Eliminating the expansion on Medicaid, forcing the states to cover more of Medicaid, thereby denying them resources to put into other things like education, highways, infrastructure, I think is not a way forward.
Do you have the view, as many Democrats do, that this bill is all about a setup to create a tax cut down the line for the wealthy?
Well, actually, this bill is a tax cut for the wealthy. Forget down the line. You don't need down the line. You're getting rid of all of taxes where the rich have to pay an added 2.9% on their Medicare bill and other taxes that they need to pay to support universal coverage. You know, and I think the data are that, you know, someone like Warren Buffett makes, you know, millions of dollars if this bill, if the Republican health care reform goes away and poor people have to pay a lot more. That is totally cruel. That is totally backwards.
But when you're in the room with them, when you're in the room with Paul Ryan and other congressional leaders who are for such bills, they obviously don't see the bill that way or don't reveal themselves to see the bill that way. What is their logic?
I can't tell you.
You're totally bewitched by it.
There isn't a logic that is focused on health care. That's quite clear.
It's a logic
focused on something besides health care. This bill does not advance health care in this country. That's quite clear. There's no positive step, no positive step in this bill, minus two. It keeps young people age 26 on their parents' plan. Who benefits from that? Well, largely upper middle class kids. You know, I was giving a lecture at Yale in a class on healthcare. There were about, I don't know, 120, 130 kids in the class. I said, how many of you are still on your parents' health insurance plan? 95% of the hands went up, right? So the parents of kids at Yale are benefiting, right? And then it does lower the ability to get subsidies down to 0% of the poverty line. Now it's 100% of the poverty line. So the people who are caught in the so-called Medicaid gap, that is, a state hasn't expanded Medicaid, but they can't get subsidies to buy insurance in the exchanges, they now can get some subsidies. Those are the two positives in this bill.
And that's it.
That's it. Everything else in this bill totally undermines health care and the health care system that we've built.
Is there a medical system, a medical slash economic system that exists in the world that you look at, you know, piningly, if only that were ours?
I'm going to talk out of two sides of my mouth now, okay? So first of all, I don't like that question. The political scientists have this notion of path dependence. Once you go down one path, you've got all these institutional structures, legal structure, administrative things. We can't go out and say, oh, you know, Sweden, it's the best. We're just going to take it and plop it down in the United States. On the other hand, I am in the – my next book is an international comparison of 12 different healthcare systems, so to see what we can learn from all of them. And interestingly, this book is not about how we pay for healthcare so much. I mean, it does have an element that paying is important. But this book is about how do we, at the coalface, how doctors interact with patients, how hospitals interact with patients, how nurses, and how can we change that? Because ultimately, our poor performance in the healthcare space, you know, we don't do so well on infant mortality. We don't do so well on maternal mortality. We don't do so well on a lot of metrics. How do we change that? And that's something to do with the payment, but much, much more to do with how doctors are actually structuring the delivery of care in the office and in the hospital and things like that.
Zeke, your book starts off with an extended, not anecdote, but story about an elderly woman named Miss Harris. Tell me a little bit about her.
So Miss Harris, when I saw her, was 95 years old. Now she has very high and labile blood pressure. It goes up and down. As a result, she had some kidney problems. She also has heart failure. She was at her sister's house. It was a hot summer day, and she keeled over. Her sister, you know, calls 911. They take her to a nearby hospital. Doc in the emergency room determines she doesn't have a stroke, doesn't have a heart attack, but she has this rhythm thing called sick sinus syndrome. Sends her to a affiliated hospital a little further down with a cardiac unit, and they put in a cardioverter, that is an implantable shock device, and a pacemaker, all in one device, into her heart. When you ask her about it, it's very unclear that she actually consented to this.
Is the system failing her in some way?
She's getting a lot of care that it's not clear she consents to. One of the things that the palliative care nurse did almost immediately is ask her, well, Would you want to go on dialysis if your kidneys failed? No. Would you want to go into the intensive care unit if something disastrous happened? No. As she says very prominently, you know, I'm ready for God to take me. And by the way, going to the doctor is a big effort for her. The only time she leaves the house is to go to her kidney doctor, order one of her two cardiologists. And it was quite clear she was dreading the need to ask a neighbor to drive her to the doctor. This was not what she wanted.
Now, I got to tell you, I remember John Stewart once saying, he said, you know, he's talking to somebody who is very stoic about their health care and whatever. He said, look, I'm Jewish. I get gas and I go to a specialist. And yet you, Zeke, wrote an amazing article in The Atlantic some time ago saying that when you hit 75, and you're 59 now?
Correct.
You, any medication that you might be on, you're going to stop, whether it's a thing like a statin or something minor or even something serious. That's it. Why and what are you telling us?
So what I said is that any medication where the justification for taking that medicine is to prolong my life. Now, there's not every medicine is like that. Some medicines are to relieve pain. Some medicines are to relieve some other deprivation. My hearing's not perfect anymore. I survived three kids. How else could it, you know, you survive three kids unless your hearing's not perfect. So if I needed a hearing aid, I would do a hearing aid. Or if I needed some pain relief, I'd do pain relief. But I'm not trying to prolong my life after 75. And partly, I think lives have an arc.
But they've gotten longer.
Not necessarily better. You know, if you look at the curve, low levels of dementia until about, turns out 75, and then it shoots up. And at 85, it's, you know, between 33 and 50% of the population has dementia. And if you talk to the experts in Japan, everyone at 100, definitely demented. Mm-hmm. I think there are three components to a meaningful life. I'm not looking for happiness. I'm looking for meaningfulness and fulfillment. Meaningful work, meaningful relationships, and fun. It's quite clear if you look at the data, for almost all of us, meaningful work will go down, you know, by 75. Very few people after 75 are productive in their work. Okay, so then you're left with fun and meaningful relationships. Interestingly, both require pretty good cognitive function. And if you don't have that, then, you know, and I don't want to risk, you know, being deteriorated and being a big burden on my kids, I think that would be the worst situation. My just hanging on and being a burden on my kids just to have more years. That does not seem valuable to me. And a life where the dominant thing is only fun or play or, you know, doing crossword puzzles, watching TV, reading a few books, seeing the grandkids once every month or something. That's not a meaningful life. I don't want that life. I don't think anyone should find that life fulfilling.
I guarantee you, Zeke, when your article came out or people listening now, you can almost hear the voices saying, now, wait a minute. It's meaningful to me. I'm 82. I'm seeing my grandchildren on Tuesday. It's meaningful to me. You think that's deluded.
I would challenge them if that really is meaningful or if what they have done is narrowed down what constitutes meaningfulness for them to accommodate their limitations, physical, cognitive, and whatever. And that's, I think, part of the big issue. I think it changes your idea if you know that, you know, at 75, it's really going to be, I don't know that it's going to be over, that I'm going to die, but it's going to be very different. My certainly ability to work and be productive that way is going to go down. And so I think you change how you approach the now and the living.
Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, his new book is Prescription for the Future. By the way, we checked back with Emanuel after the Senate released its most recent bill, and he said the revisions, as far as he's seen, don't really change his opinion at all. We're going to stay on this topic, and in a minute, the long, strange history of universal health coverage, a battle that's been fought now for fully 100 years. It's the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. My colleague Jill Lepore is not only a great journalist here at the New Yorker, but she's a professor of history at Harvard and a terrific one, and we depend on her to actually know things. Jill, while Congress and the political class are slugging it out on a medical bill, it's worth going back to the history of this. Universal access to health care in the United States was first seriously considered in the 1910s, right? Where early healthcare activists were drawing inspiration from where?
Well, from their own experience in the U.S., the United States had all kinds of provisions for federal assistance after the Civil War. It spent a quarter of the federal budget on aid between 1880 and 1910, but especially from Europe, where sickness insurance had started in Germany in the 1880s, and in 1911, Parliament passed a National Insurance Act. And there was a lot of optimism in the United States during the height of the Progressive Era before the First World War, that nationalized health insurance was pretty much on the docket in the 19-teens.
It was on the docket, and where did it go? What was its fate?
It went down into the trash bin of history to be long forgotten. So it really was by about 1916 that the measure had gained a lot of momentum. It had been introduced in a lot of states, especially in California. There was discussion in Congress, and there were a few different obstacles. The chief one that didn't affect the UK and the reason for the delay, so the UK had adopted the reform in 1911. In 1912, the United States began to consider it, but the UK doesn't have a written constitution, and our written constitution was a real impediment for progressive reformers, for all kinds of reform that was attempting to regulate the suffering of ordinary people under mass industrialism, that the Constitution hadn't foreseen that, and it was very difficult to imagine how to defeat constitutional arguments. People who were opposed to sickness insurance could call it unconstitutional. And so there was a question of whether or not there was going to be a need for a constitutional amendment. It involved all kinds of delays. So it really wasn't until 1916 that there was enough momentum to get kind of over that constitutional hurdle. And then months after that, the United States entered the war with Germany, and the people who were arguing against insurance were able to successfully defeat it by pointing out that it was born in Germany.
Well, this is it. There were claims that universal health care would cause the Prussianization of America, or that somehow insurance for all would give the Kaiser a foothold in California. What did all that mean?
It was just very effective political rhetoric is what it mainly meant. And you can see how effective it was because people keep going back to it again and again. And if you look at the whole century between then and now of this struggle, sometimes people say, oh, we're rushing into healthcare. We're not rushing into anything. We've been doing this for a century. But the arguments against it always are xenophobic. First, it's the Germans. Then by the time we get to
the it's the Germans. What do the Germans have to do with us? I have to say this issue confounds me no end. Why? What is wrong with universal health care? Why is it somehow un-American?
It grants too much power over the individual to the state. So it's statism. It's collectivism. And what form of collectivism it is changes over time, right? Because it's a specious argument. So either it's socialism, sometimes it's communism. By the time Obama was elected, then it was just sort of vaguely European. And now it's actually liberalism. But remember that this actually, this debate started in the United States during the kind of heyday of social Darwinism. So a lot of the people who opposed national health insurance were social Darwinists who just sort of felt like, hey, if you can't make it, this is survival of the fittest.
Is there an element of social Darwinism now?
I think there is. I mean, there's a kind of laissez-faire, kind of reborn free marketism that is fundamentally socially Darwinist. And the trick there is how insufficient have been the arguments for the made by the advocates of national health insurance, because they're so easily cowed by these critiques of collectivism, as if republicanism isn't a form of collectivism, as if we are not tied as a nation by bonds of affection and community and solidarity
and institutions,
and sacrifice and institutions that bind us to one another, right? Like that's how people could be so easily silenced. I mean, you can understand at particular moments, like World War I. Okay, we're fighting a war with Germany. It's going to be really hard to get this through. You can kind of understand the heyday of the Cold War. Okay, if they're going to call it Stalinist, it's going to be tough for us.
Well, let's pause on that. In 1945, the Second World War ends. The governor of California is Earl Warren, who would eventually obviously go to the Supreme Court. And Harry Truman and Warren both try to institute universal health care insurance. Was there something about that political moment that made both men think they could win?
There were two things about that political moment. There was the prosperity of the moment and the hopefulness of the moment. There was the GI Bill and the support that had received. And GI Bill is nothing if not federal legislation that is essentially welfare for veterans. The idea that we have come out of the war with a sense of common cause, having defeated forms of collectivism and statism and cherished what makes the United States distinctive, the success of the New Deal reforms. Truman wanted to continue the New Deal with his Fair Deal.
Now, personally, I've always understood that the Constitution of the United States imposes upon the government of the United States a responsibility with respect to the general welfare of its citizens. And certainly, no one can pretend that good health is not a matter of first importance so far as the general welfare is concerned. That is why, ever since I've been president, I have recommended programs which I believe will provide better medical health and services for all our people.
So, as I understand it, Warren and Truman run into the most unlikely kind of opposition. They were sunk by a pair of consultants named Leon Baxter and Clem Whitaker, who ran an organization called Campaigns, Inc. Who were Whitaker and Baxter, and what was their approach to politics?
They were both former newspaper people who had gone into the advertising industry at the outset. In the 1930s, they eventually marry. They're this incredible team. They're both pistols. They run a newspaper feature service, and they become incredibly successful running political campaigns as a kind of offshoot of their advertising agency. They run to the right, and they are hired by the American Medical Association when Truman announces his national health insurance plan, because their work in California defeating Warren's California health insurance plan was so phenomenally successful.
You know, Jill, the California State Archives gave us a transcript of a 1950 radio spot produced by Whitaker and Baxter, and we've tried to recreate it. This is what we imagine it sounded like.
The American people are registering their firm and outspoken opposition to socialized medicine. Public opinion is rapidly crystallizing on the crest of a wave of resolutions opposing any form of compulsory tax-supported sickness insurance. Today, more than 5,000 national, state, and local organizations are on record and have advised their senators and congressmen in Washington that they want no part of any paternalistic, bureaucratically controlled system of political medicine. They have emphatically stated that their members are against compulsion or regimentation in any field. The millions of citizens represented by these groups are a mobilization of free-thinking people who believe in the preservation of individual initiative and the American way of life. Today's private system of medicine has produced the highest health standards in the world. That system must be preserved.
What do you make of that, Jill?
Well, remember this moment, right? It really is the height of the fear of a worldwide communist conspiracy. So 1949, China becomes communist, Soviet Union gets the bomb, 1950, Alger Hiss, the Whitaker Chambers hearings. People are convinced that the United States, the American way of life, is under threat, that the Soviets are just about to take over, that the secret subversion of the American way of life at the hands of people in the State Department and in the federal government is part of a worldwide conspiracy. So Whitaker and Baxter very effectively play on those fears. And a measure of just how successful they are and also of how much people wanted this reform, the first thing they did when they were hired to work on the national campaign was go to Washington, and they talked to a lot of members of Congress, and they asked if they could look at constituent mail. And they read a whole lot of mail, and they found that Americans favored Truman's proposal 4-1 when they started. They had a huge $3 million budget from the AMA, and 9 months later, they looked at the mail again, and Americans were opposed to Truman's plan, 4-1. And that was pretty much just the money that they spent making their argument, which was that Truman's plan, it was sort of like a domino theory, right, that this was the first step in the descent into socialism.
So why did the AMA, the American Medical Association, which was for universal insurance during the Progressive Era, go to being opposed to universal insurance? What happened to the AMA?
Medical expenses rose. And this is actually the great tragedy of the long delay of the United States federal government in actually finally facing this issue, is with each passing year, the cost of medicine rises. And it's much more difficult to institute the reform, both because there's just more money at stake and it's hard to figure out where the money's going to come from, but also because doctors are making more money. And in the 1940s and 1950s, the AMA is hugely opposed because doctors are making a lot of money, and they would like to not have their pay limited by the federal government, by reimbursement, that's rates that are going to be set by the federal government.
Now, eventually, President Johnson was able to expand healthcare coverage in the United States in 1965, creating programs that are still very much with us, Medicaid and Medicare.
I'm so proud that this has come to pass in the Johnson administration. But it was really Harry Truman of Missouri who planted the seeds of compassion and duty, which have today flowered into care for the sick and serenity for the fearful.
Jill, how was Johnson able to pull this off?
LBJ flew in deer meat from Texas to feed to members of Congress at breakfast that he held every week to get them to pony up to his legislative agenda. He would meet with them every week with a kind of poster board on an easel and give them just an incredible Texas breakfast with big slabs of bacon and this and eggs and toast. And he would make this chart and he would tell them exactly what they needed to do that week to get through the Great Society. And he had this, you know, he had this urgency about it. He knew that he had a limited amount of time. He'd swept into office. He had the sympathy of people because of Kennedy's assassination. And he got through these programs that he couldn't actually really run, but that he instituted with incredible effectiveness, right down to flying out to Missouri to sign the Medicare Act in the Truman Presidential Library in front of Truman, who guy nearly wept. I mean, the beauty of that for Truman 20 years later, to see that this reform that FDR had tried to get through, that Wilson had tried to get through, that had been this long, simmering, lingering piece of American suffering was going to be addressed. LBJ knew what he was doing is the thing.
In this town and 1,000 other towns like it, there are men and women in pain who will now find ease. There are those alone in suffering who will now hear the sound of some approaching footsteps coming to help. There are those fearing the terrible darkness of despairing poverty, despite their long years of labor and expectation, who will now look up to see the light of hope and realization.
Well, we're looking at a situation in which people seem to not know what they're doing, especially politically. What do you make of the current effort to repeal Obamacare and maybe replace it with the American Health Care Act? Is it unusual for Congress to pass a bill which takes benefits away from people? Has that ever happened?
I think you might think about Clinton's welfare to work plan. I think very much that was pitched as a rearrangement of a set of benefits. The scale of this, no, this is its own particular crisis. I mean, what's, I think, kind of terrifying about this current moment is that the enemy is now no longer foreign. The enemy is within the United States.
Well, I guess it leaves us with the question, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the fate of universal health care? Has the argument to any degree, whether it's during the Clinton time or now during Obamacare, has the argument for universal health care coverage made any significant advance so that one day we might see universal health care coverage?
I think that Republicans in Congress are obviously floundering. They don't know what they're doing. They have a hard time talking about anything. But rhetorically, the Democrats in Congress are the ones who would need to step up for us to achieve universal health care. And they would need to reclaim an argument about the common good. They would need to be able to speak with the kind of universalism that of liberalism that animated Johnson and Johnson's more soaring speeches on this subject. And until they do, they cannot defeat even a weakened argument against healthcare.
Jill, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave.
My colleague, Jill Lepore. You can find her piece on the history of universal health coverage and everything else she's written for The New Yorker at newyorkerradio.org.
How are you?
Great.
Good to see you.
You look younger. I wouldn't have figured out.
I'm getting younger all the time. I
The Israeli writer Edgar Keret was in town recently, and I wouldn't miss a chance to catch up with him. In The New Yorker, we've published some of his terrific short stories, but his most recent book in English, The Seven Good Years, is more of a memoir. Edgar talks about life and death, fatherhood, terrorism, politics, angry birds, prenatal yoga. It's as funny and as dark and somehow as sweet as his stories.
As a writer of fiction in Israel, I'd love to know, and I bet you other people would want to know, what's going on in the world of Israeli fiction? We usually hear, to be honest, the same four or five names for a long period of time. You're considered a young writer, and you're how old?
I'll be 50 this year.
Yeah, so what's happening in the fictional realm in Israel that we don't know about and we should and might soon?
I think that the biggest new name is Ayelet Gundar, who had written a novel that was very well accepted in Israel, and I think that it just came out or about to come out in the States.
What's it called?
I don't remember the title. I remember the story. I think it's better. It's about a doctor who by mistake hit and kills an illegal African worker. And basically runs away, and the wife of this, or the widow of this man, kind of extorts him to open some kind of a hospital, a illegal hospital in which he'll take care of illegal foreign workers. And it's about how basically this kind of encounter changes his perception and challenges his worldview, you know.
You've got a book coming.
I'm supposed to finish it by the end of the year.
And do you have time to read or watch, see movies or do anything on your own lately? You've been writing a lot.
Well, actually, when I came here to New York, I came with my son, so I've seen the kind of stuff that would interest him too.
How old is he?
11.
What's his name?
Lev.
And what interests him?
So his English isn't that great. So we went to a musical. We saw Groundhog Day.
How was it?
Very good.
Yeah?
Very good. It's actually, it's the second.
Has he seen the movie?
I've seen the movie and really liked it.
Yeah.
The musical is kind of is different in a good way, because the idea of making a musical based, you know, on a film sounds like a bad idea, or
it always sounds like a bad idea,
Very capitalistic one, you know. but it actually is different and makes sense, and it's the second musical I see in my life.
You're kidding.
The first one was Starlight Express.
Oh, my God.
And I didn't like it.
Wasn't that on roller skates or something?
On roller skates. I was 10 years old.
Oh, my God.
I really didn't like it. And I said to my parents, please don't ever take me to a musical again. And this was my second one. And it's kind of, I've seen the light. I've tap danced all the way back home, you know.
And no roller skates?
No roller skates.
I should tell you, just as a matter of information, the majority of musicals do not have roller skates. The majority.
No, it wasn't the roller skates that killed me. I think that there is something about it, about musicals, that usually, like, people there are amazing. You know, they know how to sing, they know how to dance. And so usually, like, they're so busy showing you they're amazing that you don't get any time to do anything else. It's like those people in American Idol that, you know, that have amazing voice and they can sing very well, but they're so busy singing very well that they don't really think what they're thinking about, you know. So this was my impression of musicals, like, you know, that you see, it's like kind of a circus, you know.
Yeah.
But this one was really nice, like, they, you know, they acted well, and it was even philosophical in a sense, because the premise is very philosophical.
It's the nature of time.
Yeah, and the idea of this kind of eternal repetition, you know, it's very Nietzschean.
Nature.
Yeah, in nature, really, because this idea of, like, if you revisit something, what would you think about it, you know? And the thing about me, I'm the kind of person who usually, when I live so much in the present, you know, that I usually don't kind of take into account anything that I've done. So when I see this, I suddenly say, wow, like, you know, if I would have gone through that, maybe I too would have became a better person and knew better how to sing and dance.
And your son enjoyed it?
He enjoyed it a lot. You know, when we sat there,
even though his English is not so great.
I think the story or the premise is very simple. And before he said, Father, I just want to say to you straight, I prefer films. And when I said to him, you know what, like, as a rule of thumb, I also prefer films, because when it's not good, it's really embarrassing, because the people are there in front of you. And but when it's good, it's better than films. And
yeah.
When the show was over, he said, you know what, Dad, you were right. This was better than a film.
Sometimes it's like I'm stumbling forward, hustled forward, jostled from behind by time. Sometimes it's like I'm being dragged, yet always lagging, trying to keep in time with time.
That's Edgar Carret. The novel he mentioned, by Ayelet Grunder Goshen, is called Waking Lions, and it was published in English this year. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Well, on paper, my life seemed great. I had a dream job, swanky apartment, and a loving girlfriend, but I don't know what it was. Something felt off. So I decided to quit my job and travel the world, bringing only my passport, a small backpack, and my enormous, enormous trust fund. My coworkers were shocked. but I don't expect everyone to get me. I'm a free spirit whose father owns a South American rubber empire. So, classic me, I set to work throwing out most of my possessions. Think about it, you don't need to own a lot of stuff to be happy. And also, in the backpack I was carrying was millions of dollars. Oh, I wish you guys could have been there. My first few months roaming the world were life-changing. I'm talking every day I updated my Instagram with photos of my favorite sites. Me taking a selfie in front of a pink wall. Me taking a selfie in front of a gray wall. Me taking a selfie in front of a mirror, which is basically infinity selfies. My hand lightly resting on a cafe table near an early edition of On the Road, with the pages creased just a little bit to make it feel like I had read it, but I hadn't opened it yet. And I can't believe I'm sharing this with you, but I want you to feel what I felt. One time, outside the train station of a small fishing village, I met a humble man named Gribo. He sold flowers and various cheap trinkets for a living. Gribo was happy to open up to me about his life, his losses, his loves, as long as I kept buying roses. And not the cheap ones, Gribo said, because I was a man of stature. Intrigued by our easy chatter, some of his friends wandered over to join the conversation. All of our superficial differences soon melted away. Like when you melt gold to mold into a new necklace that says your name. As I left town, I cast one final glance back at Gribo. One of his friends playfully tossed him to the ground and thumbed his eyes as the other snatched all the money I had given him. I couldn't help but smile. It felt good to make a difference in the lives of these simple, simple people. And now that I'm thinking about it, I'm not quite certain his name was Gribo. Listen, maybe this no reservations lifestyle isn't for everyone, but don't worry about me. You know, whenever I start to get homesick, I just remember the old rat race and I go, ugh, all those bleary-eyed suckers packed into a subway cart like sardines, going to their lousy jobs to afford useless things like rent and health insurance and student loan payments. See, that lifestyle isn't for me. Maybe I'm just a crazy dreamer who also gets a monthly no-strings-attached $60K deposit into my checking account, but I won't be tied down so easily. His name definitely wasn't Gribo.
Why I Quit My Job to Travel the World, A True Story, or Not, by Joe Vikes from The New Yorker's Daily Shouts column. It was performed for us by Ben Schwartz. In June, Elon Musk of SolarCity, of the Tesla battery-powered car, and now the CEO of SpaceX, outlined a plan to send a manned mission to Mars. Here's Musk speaking at a conference last year.
We're establishing cargo flights to Mars that people can count on. We should be able to launch people probably in 2024 with arrival in 2025.
In other words, according to the tech gurus, there's big money to be made in space. And where there's big money, people will do whatever they can to go get it. After all, it's space. Who's going to stop them? New Yorker contributor Simon Parkin went to find out.
I do quite a bit of cycling around these areas, and I have had two rather spectacular accidents on the bike. So, just be careful driving. Country roads are treacherous. Yeah. Just left here. Nice pub here in Hounds.
I'm on the outskirts of Farnham, a town a little less than an hour from South London in bucolic suburban Surrey. This part of England is dotted with picturesque villages, each one defined by well-manicured hedges, colourfully named pubs and local eccentrics. Sitting next to me is one such eccentric. His name is Dr. Phil Davies.
You go past quite a delightful little pub called the Bluebell, and stop about here, actually.
Okay. This is the Alice Holt Forest, which stretches out across Hampshire.
Straight ahead.
Dr. Phil leads me behind a pub onto a gravel pathway that snakes off into the woods.
So it is on a public walkway.
A little way along, we emerge into a clearing with trees on three sides, and on the fourth, an arrestingly panoramic view of the English countryside.
Right. Yeah. So the land's falling away in front of us, and so you can see right down to sort of 5 degrees, really, off the horizon.
The unobstructed horizon is what brings Phil to this clearing a couple of times a week. He comes here at night, He brings a telescope on which is mounted a high-powered laser. And with some precision, he then fires that laser at the planet Mars.
A pair of buzzards. Are they buzzards? They look.
You do get birds of prey hovering around here, yeah.
So, yeah, we definitely don't want to be firing off lasers willy-nilly, setting light to local birds of prey.
Unless you're really hungry and you can find where it lands.
That would be spectacular.
Phil is a man with a plan, and I'm here to try to understand that plan. So from the Alice Holt Forest, we head back to his flat, which doubles as his armoury.
Wow, this is all the gear.
Amazing. It's a small room, but I do sort of...
A lot of telescopes.
Yeah.
Phil is a country doctor, a GP. He divides his time between Farnham and his native Belfast, where his wife still lives. In his Farnham bachelor pad, he's laid out a quiver of lasers on a low coffee table. These are not the kind of lasers teachers use to point at a blackboard. They're more like the ones Ernst Blofeld uses to threaten James Bond.
I have got, legally, the strongest lasers I can get my hands on. I mean, our strongest laser here is 3,500 milliwatts. That's kind of 3,500 times stronger than the average handheld classroom laser pointer.
So what we've got here is a stubby, fat telescope that looks a bit maybe like a rocket launcher, and it's stood on a tripod that's, I guess, the size of an Oompa Loompa, so about to waist height. It's got a big danger sign on it. And then there's a big red button on here. What's that for? Is that to turn it on?
Yeah. I mean, we started with very trivial lasers, but the first time I had a powerful laser, it was wow. I mean, it's a lightsaber into the night. It really is. And it looks like it's touching Mars, this little planet at the end of this long finger.
When Phil shoots one of these monster lasers at Mars, he sends a beam of photons through the Earth's atmosphere, across 34 million miles of space, and to the surface of the planet. A lot of those photons spin off into the darkness, but some hit the mark. Those photons heat up the surface of Mars, ever so slightly, infinitesimally. But making Mars even a very, very tiny bit warmer technically makes it a very, very tiny bit more hospitable for human settlement.
They're just coffees. And people who talk about how would you improve Mars to make it ready for humans to go there, they talk about there being a need for an atmosphere. So how would you get an atmosphere on Mars? Well, you'll see it. You just go to Wikipedia and look up terraforming Mars, and you will see, they'll say, add light and heat, because the polar ice caps, and actually the whole planet, but mainly in the poles, is full of what's called dry ice, carbon dioxide in ice form. And if you heat it up, what it does is forms a greenhouse effect. Mm-hmm. Nasty thing on Earth, but actually what would benefit Mars greatly. And this is all a bit theoretical, but what is true, though, is we are adding extra heat and light to Mars.
Dr. Phil may be eccentric, but he's not mad. A few years ago, Elon Musk told Stephen Colbert about the fast way to get more CO2 into the Martian atmosphere.
Give me the fast way.
The fast way is drop thermonuclear weapons over the poles.
You're a supervillain. That's what a supervillain does.
Yeah.
Now, Dr. Phil has a handheld laser and not a thermonuclear weapon, but the idea is essentially the same: to make Mars more pleasant for humans. And by preparing Mars for human habitation, Phil thinks that he can make a claim that he owns the planet. He's been reading up on the international law that covers how to claim ownership of a distant, barren land.
They were thinking Antarctica and some distant islands. The general thought is, no longer for that sort of land do you actually have to go and plant a flag there. You literally have to show intent to possess, and also ideally show some early effort to improve the land to make it ready for human settlement and trade. And so if you think about it, that's kind of what I've been trying to do with Mars.
So Phil filled out the appropriate forms and sent them off to the UN. When did you hear back from them and what did they say?
Well, yes, we did get, eventually last year, we got a reply from a director at UNUSA, United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs, who said, yeah, it's interesting, but we are the secretariat. So this is the difficulty when dealing with the UN. We're not the body that can decide for you. We just create the situation for the committee to come.
In an effort to up the pressure on the UN and to drum up some capital to cover his legal fees, Phil hit on a curious idea. You know how you can buy those novelty deeds to plots of land on the moon? Well, Phil sells similar plots of land on Mars. The difference being that Phil's aren't novelties. They're intended to be legal deeds. And if he's granted ownership of the planet, he'll have neighbours.
Given that there are people out there charging guys $25 for 1 acre of celestial land, which is just a novelty deed, we're actually saying, hey, have 100,000 acres for a dollar or a cent even, a cent. And effectively, it's just because we're saying, join us in this campaign. Then I've now got nearly 13,000 members.
Phil thinks that when he gets the right people at the UN to look at his claim, it'll stand up. And you know what? It's not out of the question. I talked to Dr. Philip de Man, a scholar of space law at the University of Leuven in Belgium.
Well, I think that his claim as such is treated as a more serious claim simply because of the objectives of the claim and the way that it's actually been backed up. So there is a legal document that he has prepared together with a number of lawyers that do actually present some interesting approaches to the problem that maybe haven't been raised before.
So, okay. But the question remains, why do this? Why spend your nights shooting a laser up into the sky? Why spend your days grappling with the bureaucracy at the UN? What's Phil's endgame here? What's a country doctor in Farnham going to do with an entire planet anyway? To explain the purpose of all this, you need to understand three things. First off, there's something called the Outer Space Treaty. It actually has a much longer official name, but that'll work for our purposes. It was adopted exactly 50 years ago, in 1967, and it's the basis for most of the laws that govern what humans can and can't do in outer space.
Meanwhile, the Foreign Minister presided at the signing of the treaty banning nuclear weapons from outer space. He pledged Britain's wholehearted support. Without such a treaty, life on Earth would be under continual threat, a nightmare existence.
The Outer Space Treaty was principally concerned with two things: keeping nukes out of space and making sure that of whoever made it to the moon first, the Soviets or the Americans, neither would be able to claim the moon as their own. On all other counts, the treaty is pretty vague. It's actually only 3 pages long. And today, all kinds of stuff is happening in space that nobody seriously anticipated in 1967. Orbital construction platforms, space tourism, asteroid mining.
Deep Space Industries. Deep Space is a new kind of company with a new kind of plan. We don't build rockets. We don't do astronomy. We are explorers and harvesters, makers and suppliers.
So the second thing you need to know is that some of these new space companies are looking for ways to exploit the vagueness of the Outer Space Treaty. And nations with space businesses are inclined to interpret space law to favour those businesses.
As activities in space increase, they will undoubtedly pose new challenges.
This is the chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on Space Science and Competitiveness, Senator Ted Cruz.
Therefore, it's incumbent on Congress to use this 50-year anniversary of the Outer Space Treaty to properly determine our actual international obligations.
Here's Philip de Man, the Belgian space law expert again.
There's no single state that's going to adopt a national law that says that their industry cannot go to outer space and cannot mine the natural resources. What we're going to end up with is a race to the bottom where everybody just wants to adopt legislation that is going to spur their own national industry. There's not really going to be much left of the general spirit of the Outer Space Treaty, which is very much one of international cooperation, of peaceful exploration of outer space.
Let's say they rip into the space treaty, and if you've only got one thing that stops nuclear weapons going into space, and you've got nations that are credible, like the US, ripping into that treaty, then what's to stop a less credible nation, or maybe a more malevolent nation, deciding to send up nuclear components into space and say, well, okay, you're saying we broke the space treaty. Well, we're not the first. Look.
So that's the last thing you need to understand, and the reason for Phil's projects, for the lasering, the theoretical terraforming, the petitions to the UN. Phil doesn't intend to take over Mars. Phil's ambition, which is a hair less quixotic, if no less grand, is to protect space and maybe save the Earth as well, by forcing the UN to rewrite the Outer Space Treaty for the 21st century.
If I run a campaign to get the space treaty updated, where is that going to get me? We know what the UN's like. But if I could develop a claim that actually did have some legal merit and then say, right, look, the space treaty has too many holes to even stop a claim like that. Now, come on, that'll embarrass them and that'll make them update it.
If the UN receives a petition that legally they can't ignore, they'd have to do something about it. Because if a country doctor from Farnham can lay claim to Mars, then what could a multi-million dollar spacefaring company accomplish?
We are deep space. The frontier is coming, and our time is now.
What are you doing now?
Just putting in a battery.
Back in Farnham, I asked Dr. Phil to show me his lasers in action. It's the middle of the day, so we need to fire them inside if I'm going to see them.
That's for you.
Phil sets up a cardboard box on the other side of the room and aims his equipment. His claim to changing the environment of Mars by terraforming is built around a laser that can be defeated by a piece of cardboard.
Make sure your glasses are on.
They're on. Oh, there it is.
Now, so again.
Very bright.
And you can't actually see it coursing.
In my glasses, it's showing up as kind of magnesium or brilliant purple. What we need is some dry ice in here, and then we'd have the world's most localized disco.
Start to see smoke and the blackening.
Yeah. Actually, there is a mark. Is that, it's already got some charred pinpoint on the
after just 10 seconds. Yeah. So there you are. There's reason for safety.
Dr. Phil will never rule a Martian colony. He will never be crowned King of Mars, and he knows this. But I think he would have been a benevolent king, this mild-mannered country doctor. And if Phil's right, if his plans work and the space treaty is rewritten, we might all benefit from his benevolence.
Is this Mars here?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's the size of a large snow globe, and it looks like Mars, and it's rotating. Is it on a motor, or is it...
It's a globe suspended in fluid, and light will induce a rotation.
So you're holding it in your hand now. You look kind of like a megalomaniac. This is the planet that I own.
That is not the intention. And now that you've pointed that out, I can see how that could be misconstrued. That will be a gift for somebody quite soon.
Simon Parkin in Farnham, England, with Dr. Phil Davies. If you want to buy one of Davies' plots of land on Mars, you go ahead and look him up online. I'm not in the real estate business. I'm David Remnick, and that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrato. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.